welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Talker here in Washington, D.C. And we're about to get come on the line and give us an update on the very legal moves to expose and reveal the intrinsic disqualification of Sammy Sotero to be president of the United States. We'll get to that in just a minute, as soon as our technical conditions allow, and if I can get the studio to turn it down. Thank you very much. Obviously, the big story this week, the destruction of the U.S. auto industry, the breaking of the United Auto Workers, the destruction of trade unionism, the obvious tactic of the Obama administration, and that's what we see in Chrysler. This is the beginning of the end of manufacturing in North America. It is the devolution and thermodynamic collapse of this entire part of the world, Canada, U.S., and Mexico, as a result of a policy of deindustrialization. And that is what the Chrysler charade means. Obviously, if you go back to Paul Adolf Volcker, who sits today in Obama's White House as the kind of gray eminence presiding over this entire thing, then you can see that he did deindustrialization one way. Obama does it another way. Obama does it under left cover, and most people are simply too stupid to realize that this is what Obama's doing, that he's an agent of Wall Street finance capital, and his job is the completion of the deindustrialization process. Now, do we have Phil Berg?
We have Phil Berg.
Hi, Phil. Sorry, if you'd spoken up, I didn't realize you were there. Well, we understand you're under time pressure, so we'd like to have you come on and give us an update every week about the progress of your legal procedures and any other thing you think relevant, so please take it away.
Well, not much has happened, but I'm continuing with my pursuit of Obama. We have three cases that are active right now, and on those cases, I think that one of these days, some judge someplace is going to give me a breakthrough. You know, it's just time will tell. The three cases, real quickly, are the one case which I took up the Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court didn't want to do anything with. You know, I was trying to get some injunctions out of them. But with that, the it's now pending in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And we have tentatively oral argument is scheduled with the last week in May, the first week in June. What happens with that is they give you a tentative date. As we get closer, they'll either schedule a date or say, you know, we're going to reschedule. So
those will be public hearings, right?
Yes, it will be. And maybe we can even get some national media to cover it. I doubt it. but hopefully the Third Circuit will do something with the case. You know, who knows? But if not, you know, and we have the case now in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. I don't know what's going to happen there. The judge there who dismissed our interpleader case, he was really outrageous, you know, in handling the case. In my opinion, he was prejudiced from day one. And with that...
Absolutely.
You know, even I'm trying to impose sanctions on our local attorney. So that case. Then we have the case under seal, which I still can't talk about it. I hope that case will be a case that will break the ice, move us in the right direction. Just waiting on the court for that. So I can't discuss it. But we're going to file, you know, and I keep talking about quo warranto. Some other attorneys have come around and filed a quo warranto, and God bless them. Like I said, I don't care how we cross the finish line. I'm the first guy out of the box. Most people are using stuff that they got from me. And again, I don't really care on that. You know, I'm not trying to be a pig on it or anything like that. What I do not like is the fact that Orly Tates, and I'm starting to talk about her now, she has, as far as I'm concerned, she should be disbarred. She's doing, I believe, everything in her power to knock down everyone's efforts. She's trying to... attack me at this point with the she's trying to attack me with the knocking of one of the people working for me, which makes absolutely no sense. But she said she's going to take down this Lisa who's doing work for me to get at Phil Berg. Well, there's no reason to get at Phil Berg other than perhaps she's working for Obama or I don't know what she's doing. People say how much press she's received. She's gotten all kinds of press, but it's negative as far as I'm concerned. She's not appealing to the new people. We have to appeal to the new people. She just filed another lawsuit here, which is outrageous. She probably had probably filing it, but it just got docketed. But from back January 20th, she filed it January 20th in the afternoon and sues Acting Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Well, Condoleezza Rice, by the afternoon of January 20th, was not even in office. and the reason I'm saying this is, she recently wrote a letter to the FBI and the CIA asking them to investigate the Supreme Court. Stating that her material was not given to the justices by Danny Bickle, the clerk of the Supreme Court. I think she's, I understand she got her law degree from a mail order, law school, and maybe that's why, but her actions really, as far as I'm concerned, are unbecoming a professional attorney. And her trying to knock me to take me out, I have no base, I don't understand anything, because other than this federal case that she has filed, I don't see anything else in the works. She's sending around a quo warranto case to many people, to many attorney generals and district attorneys, and telling them to file it to go after Obama. That's not how you do a quo warranto case. You know, she's getting press, but I don't think the press is something that if you look at it, and the people that are listening that are really following me, if you watch what she's doing, other than getting some press, which is real questionable as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't attract the new people. And I'm trying to attract the new people to this so that we can get we need more and more people involved in this. Right now, I believe we have 10, 15 million people involved, and we have to raise that number to like 15 million, to 20 million. And you can only do that by, in my opinion, by being focused. And I don't think
the other problem, of course, with Orly Tates is that she's a right wing reactionary, and there are a lot of people who want to keep this whole thing within the idiotic bankrupt profile of leftists against rightists. And obviously, you as a leading Democrat, a former Hillary Clinton supporter, you bust up that idiotic paradigm of mass manipulation. And if they can just get a reactionary like Orly Tates in there, then they can reconstruct the entire thing. And she's used, obviously, to deprive you of coverage that would, by rights, go to you.
Well, and I don't care about that. But I do care now that she's, because now her actions are detrimental to the cause. The cause is one thing. And that is, the question is Barack Obama constitutionally eligible to be president of the United States? I say no. I say he's constitutionally ineligible, and We need to attract more people. We have to hope that some judge someday will give us discovery, and I'm hoping that on my case under seal, or I'm hoping that on one of these court of appeals cases. But until that takes place, then we have to keep trying to get the American public. Like, Obama just recently came out and basically is condemning all the Tea Parties that occurred. The national media didn't cover the Tea Parties. Well, the Tea Parties attracted over a million people across the United States, according to reports I've seen. The national media is like making no light. Obama is saying it's nothing. It is something. It's a great start. Many of them had our signage out there, I hear, but we need more. Many of them had signs, Mr. Obama, where's your birth certificate?
Correct, but the other thing is that Republican operatives, Heritage Foundation types, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Heartland Institute, the Buckley think tank set were in there telling people that they couldn't have their Obama signs. They had to stick with, free markets and the rest of this claptrap.
Well, I'm hoping everyone should go to obamacrime.com, spread it to everyone on your email list, get the word out there more. We're the front runner, and also if you can give us some money, we could use it.
Great. Thank you, Phil. We'll see you next week. Hang in there.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. I want to thank Phil Berg for coming on every week, and I urge you to go to his website, ObamaCrimes.com, and give him a contribution, because this is an important public service. And let's look at some of these Johnny-come-latelys. I mean, Orly Tates was nowhere. She was not there at the Supreme Court back at the end of August when Phil Berg filed his attempt for an injunction to stop the Democratic Convention from nominating the presumable illegal alien Barry Sotero. The controlled corporate Wall Street right-wing media were not there. Fox News, let's take them. Fox News is now all over the Tea Party movement as if they had founded it. But gee whiz, Fox News had August and September and all of October. Did they ever get Phil Berg on their Fox network to talk about the fact that Obama was not qualified for the presidency? No, they did not. How about Limbaugh? Did he get Phil Berg on his radio show and interview him in depth? No, Limbaugh did not. Hannity did not. Savage, Michael Savage, was the one who had him on. That was, I think, an important program. That was the number fourth or fifth largest radio talk show. But you see the bad faith of these reactionaries, the Buckley school, the William Buckley neocon or con artists or whatever they are, talk a big game of being opposed to Obama. But then on the main issues, they pull their punches completely and they let the charade go on. So you ought to learn something from that. If Fox News shows up at your tea party, say, hey, Foxies, where were you guys back in August and September and October when Berg was out there fighting to expose Obama and you guys wouldn't give him the time of day, the one exception being a local Fox News in Ohio, I believe, or Pennsylvania, had him on, but no network coverage. So it shows the bad faith. And, of course, we know Rupert Murdoch, the owner of this Fox operation, flirted in public with Obama quite extensively, right, that he was wanted to meet him, that he found him such a wonderful surprise, reflecting basically a ruling class consensus that the Wall Street group in its totality said, look here, when it comes to imperialist wars and austerity and strike breaking, we've come to the end of the road with the right wing Bush neocon war on terror sort of approach. We've got to get the left-wing approach. We've got to throw the Hegelian dialectic into operation and bring on a period of antithesis, if you will, and we'll therefore use that for the kind of things that are going on right now. So again, Phil Berg is the one you need to support and not any of the Johnny-come-latelys and not the fakers who refuse to entertain this question of Obama's birth certificate and actual qualification for the presidency. They were not interested in the constitutional question because they don't like the Constitution when you get right down to it. And at the same time now today, if you have these think tank operatives, the Heartland Institute boys, the Competitive Enterprise Institute boys of Richard Mellon Scaife, the arch reactionary, really worse than Buckley in many ways, they were the ones out there saying, no, you can't show your Obama birth certificate signed. They wanted to suppress that and keep it within the limits of what the basically what the right wing of the Republican Party was willing to put up with. So learn from that. And the answer is do something independent. And independent is Phil Berg, and that is the ObamaCrimes.com website. You deserve, you really, you owe it to him to do something to support this effort. Now let's go back to Obama crimes of the more current type. Obama, of course, is a master of duplicity and manipulation, and he is blessed with a very stupid opposition, or maybe they're deliberately stupid, somebody like Limbaugh. Notice that Limbaugh attacks the words of Obama, but not the deeds. The deeds are ignored. The deeds, as we've seen, $12 trillion for Wall Street and maybe $300 billion for actual human needs for the survival of people in this country. So Obama is a Wall Street proposition. He goes for Wall Street 50-1 over the American people. He's a Wall Street operative. He's an agent of Wall Street Finance Capital. Of course, the best service you can do to such a person is to turn around and say he's concerned about the disadvantaged and the wretched of the earth, and he's really a closet socialist and a Marxist. Perfect. Perfect for Obama. Every such attack helps him. He can't get enough of these attacks. That's why he talks about Limbaugh Hannity all the time, too. And he would like to lock the Tea Party movement into precisely that kind of a sterile farce and charade by profiling the Tea Parties as right-wing extremists, and he can play off that. So the answer to that is, if you don't want to be profiled as a right-wing extremist, don't be one. Come up with a decent program that actually addresses how you get out of a depression. Otherwise, even in the best outcome, you can get rid of Obama, perhaps, but you're still stuck with the depression, and you'll have somebody like Newt Gingrich. Imagine that, the typical desperate, opportunistic Republican Paul trying to jump on the Tea Parties and trying to pretend that they're the head of them. Now, let's take this question a case in point, right? All we have all these Austrians running around screaming about free markets. Well, the truth is, of course, there hasn't been a free market in, what is it, 5,000 years, 10,000 years, ever since we got out of the old Stone Age. As soon as the government of any kind, state of any kind, came on the scene, you're dealing with political economy. So let's look at the Chrysler case. Obama has cynically driven Chrysler into bankruptcy. If Chrysler had been Citibank or Bank of America or Wells Fargo or J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs, they would have gotten $50 billion. That's what the average bailout has been for most of these banks. The banks have gotten $50 billion. Goldman Sachs has probably gotten more than that. Goldman Sachs has been able to go to the TARP directly and get $40 billion, I believe, and then they got another $15 billion or so through AIG. And that would be more than enough to reconvert Chrysler into producing all sorts of things. You could produce equipment for a space program. You could produce equipment for maglev high-speed rail, for commuter mass transit here in the United States, to rebuild water systems. You can produce pipes. You can produce all sorts of things. You can produce 100 high-temperature pebble-bed fourth-generation nuclear reactors. You could produce modular hospitals so that you could meet your 1,000 hospital deficit in short order. But naturally, none of that. What Obama has cynically done is to drive Chrysler into the hands of a group of predatory financiers. Now, on the surface, Obama seems to be complaining about the result, right? You know that he said, I don't stand with the hedge funds. Yeah, you work for the hedge funds. Don't tell us you don't stand with them. What he's referring to is that the possible deal to avoid bankruptcy involved a deal with certain hedge funds, which was not forthcoming, but it was Obama who had set up this situation in the first place. So don't watch his mouth. Look where his hands are going. Back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C., calling your kind attention to three indispensable books. One is Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. We'll be referring to that at various times in today's broadcast, but essentially the reasons, the causes of the current world economic depression, diagnosed in the form of deindustrialization, the decline in the standard of living, the coming of derivatives through deregulation, and the failure to regulate markets. Regulation meaning banning derivatives, banning hedge funds, banning adjustable rate mortgages. So that's Surviving the Cataclysm, www.progressivepress.com, www.progressivepress.com. Two other indispensable books, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. Barack Obama is a deeply troubled personality, the megalomaniac frontman for a postmodern coup by the intelligence agencies using fake polls, mobs of swarming adolescents, super rich contributors like George Soros, and orchestrated media hysteria to short circuit normal politics and seize power. Obama comes from the orbit of the Ford Foundation. And further on, we read here, Obama's economics are pure skull and bones, Chicago school austerity and sacrifice for America's working families, all designed to bail out the bankrupt Wall Street elitist financiers who own him. Obama's lemming legions and Kool-Aid cult candidacy harken back to Italy in 1919-1922 and raise the specter of postmodern fascism in the United States today. Obama is a recipe for a world tragedy. Well, in retrospect, that sounds pretty accurate. So get the entire book, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, and Barack H. Obama, the Unauthorized Biography, the entire ideological profile. Some guy put up on some website this week that Obama doesn't believe in anything. He's just a talented demagogue with a microphone. Wrong. He believes in Nietzsche. He believes in Fanon. He believes in basically the ideology of the left wing of the Ford Foundation, that financiers ought to rule and they ought to do it by divide and conquer. So all of those, the two, Obama the Postmodern Coup and the Unauthorized Biography of Obama at Amazon.com, the Surviving the Cataclysm for now at Progressive Press, www.progressivepress.com. Now, specifically, the application of all that, because that's what this is now, with Chrysler. At the beginning of April, he denied Chrysler any further funding. He drove them deliberately, cynically, into bankruptcy using his telegenic, smiling, left-cover face. But that's what he did. And the goal, of course, is to destroy manufacturing, to further that wrecking operation begun by Volcker back in 1979, 30 years ago, deindustrialization, the post-industrial society. We would call it the junkyard, the moonscape, the rubble field. But there it is. The service sector triumphs, and to bust the United Auto Workers. Now, clearly, in the course of this, some of these creditors say no, and these are the hedge funds, and they are indeed parasites. But, Barkey, if you didn't want to have Chrysler torn apart by hyenas and jackals, why did you throw Chrysler into the cage where hyenas and jackals were there? This refers to the Oppenheimer Fund, the Xerion, X-E-R-I-N, the Xerion Fund of Perella Weinberg and Stairway Capital, Stairway to the Inferno, I suppose. So these are the three that Obama was getting mileage out of, right? He gets to do a big imposture in front of the cameras, right? He's posing as the enemy of the hedge funds, Oppenheimer, Xerion, and Stairway. It's simply a charade. He was the one who delivered Chrysler, gagged and bound, into the hands of these hedge fund hyenas. Naturally, J.P. Morgan Chase is on the inside. They don't need to worry. They can make good any losses out of the TARP or the TALF or the PPIT or any of these other things in the Obama alphabet soup. So J.P. Morgan Chase doesn't need to worry. They can make concessions, but it's going to be these three hedge funds that are blamed. So get set for an entire demagogic performance of Barkey posturing against these three. Now, in reality, of course, it's the United Auto Workers, which has been screwed. I guess there's no other way to say it. The United Auto Workers is owed a whole bunch of future health care expenses for their members. This was all done under contracts back when there were still unions and strikes and contracts before we got into the corporate state. So what the UAW has done is that they have taken about, 45% of Chrysler stock in exchange for their future healthcare commitments. Now, what that means is that this Chrysler stock, well, it's going to go to zero, isn't it? It's going to take, it's going to behave pretty much like other stocks, but worse. So that's going to be the United Auto Workers and, above all, their members left holding the bag, holding worthless stock in Chrysler Corporation, and they will not have anywhere to turn for their future health care. That's not a good deal. That is another step towards breaking the trade union movement. It is the beginning of the end of the United Auto Workers, and this is a historical tragedy. Think back to the great sit-down strikes in Detroit in 1937. It's part of a worldwide process, right? There was a mass strike in France in the same year. In the U.S., we had the sit-down strikes in Detroit, the Toledo Auto Light strikes, the work around Walter Reuther in particular, but also others, people more radical than Walter Reuther who made a lot of this stuff happen. All of that is being destroyed by Obama under left cover, under the modern left cover, which is, of course, Malthusianism and oligarchism. So one of the results of this is that Chrysler is now bankrupt. They will shut down for how long? 30, 60 days, 90 days, 180 days, 360 days, forever? There's a good chance that Chrysler will never reopen. Now, they're talking about $8 billion from the federal government for Chrysler. Why didn't they just provide that financing before? Better yet, why didn't they do what I said? We'll get to that in a minute. Obama is now saying, well, don't worry, it's going to be a very quick bankruptcy. Not guaranteed at all, precisely because you have these hedge fund hyenas. So what he's done is he's set up a situation where he can have Chrysler destroyed and the UAW busted, and Obama can blame it on Oppenheimer, Zirion, and Stairway, who are, of course, going to respond on profile. They want their money, of course. But if you didn't want to put Chrysler at the mercy of Oppenheimer, Zirion, and Stairway, why did you drive them into bankruptcy in the first place? If you just treated them like a bank, they could be fine. They could be well on their way to being reconverted. Now, the real question here is Chrysler, of course, these assembly lines, the tool and die capability, the machine tool capability, plus the subcontractors, things like Johnson Controls, Magna International, Cummins Engine, right, Cummins Diesel. Those are all suppliers of Chrysler. Notice they don't get any attention. They can be left. These are unsecured creditors. They are left holding the bag as this thing goes down. Now, it's clear that the entire network of subcontractors in Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, right, your Wisconsin, your Great Lakes industrial complex, they're operating on, well, profit margins that are so small they're non-existent. If Chrysler goes down, which is now the case, and these other ones go down too, then what happens to Delphi? What happens to the rest of them? There's a very good possibility that the entire auto industry subcontracting sector goes down. And why should you care? Well, then you have a banana republic. You want national independence? You want dignity? You want to be something other than ethnographic material being studied by anthropologists from China or Malaysia or whatever it's going to be? Then you better have an industrial sector, people. You better have one. You better have a full set economy. And right now you're on your way to losing it. And free market will not do anything to stop it. It'll accelerate it. Back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley reporting from Washington, D.C. So Chrysler is now shutting down for 30, 60, 90 days. Nobody knows. It won't be simple. It's going to be messy. It may never end. It may be the end of Chrysler. That's about 50, 60, 70,000 jobs right there. Don't think just of jobs, though. This is key assembly line tool and die machine tool capability. General Motors is shutting down for approximately 7 weeks, And you're getting to a situation where the banks are still going. The zombie banks are all juiced up with formaldehyde from the TARP and from the PPIP from Geithner and the Fed. But the industrial heart of the United States has just about stopped. And again, if you don't want a banana republic, if you want to have an independent country, if you don't want the descent into chaos and a depression beyond your wildest dreams, you better do something to prevent Obama from destroying Chrysler and indeed from destroying the UAW, right? Just get this Gettelfinger out of there. Down with Gettelfinger. We need somebody, a trade union militant, right? Somebody who's heard what a wildcat strike is. And indeed, if we had a labor movement, the labor movement, Sweeney, where are you? Sweeney and Andy Stern, oh my God. Let's have a nationwide general strike. Don't let Chrysler be broken up and completely ravaged by these hedge fund hyenas. Look, here's a profile in Courage. The German government of Angela Merkel, of all people, Merkel, has said to J.C. Flowers. J.C. Flowers is a hedge fund hyena. He's a bottom fisher. He comes in and buys companies that are in real big trouble. He breaks them up and so forth. There's a large mortgage company in Germany called Hypo Mortgage. So it's H-Y-P-O, Hypo Mortgage. And there's a bankruptcy reorganization of this thing. And the German government has offered the J.C. Flowers hedge fund, I think, $1.25 a share for some shares in this hypo that they have. And J.C. Flowers says, no, that's not good enough. I want $6-$7. And the German government just said to J.C. Flowers, look, J.C., you either take our offer or we're going to seize it and you'll get nothing. We will expropriate you. That was an amazing word coming from the German finance minister. Die Enteignung, the expropriation of J.C. Flowers by Monday. By the time you're hearing this, it may have happened. Now, that is just the merest claw tip of the inherent executive powers of any government. But notice what Barkey does. Has Barkey ever heard of the Defense Production Act, the Trading with the Enemy Act, or the inherent powers, or the implied powers of the presidency? I guess not. Here's what I would do. I would dust off the Defense Production Act and the Trading with the Enemy Act, and I'd say, all right, Chrysler is now seized. It's nationalized by the United States of America. We are going to we're going to get rid of Nardelli. That's the one thing that Barkey accomplished, of course, is to get rid of one set of puppets. He wants to bring in somebody worse, because there is worse than Nardelli, right? Nardelli is from retail, right? Retail is not as bad as banking, right? Industry would be better, retail in the middle, and then banking worst of all. They're obviously going to get Nardelli out and bring in some kind of a hedge fund hyena, right? Somebody like Ratner the Rat, remember him? The head of the auto task force, Steve Ratner, former New York Times columnist and journalist turned into a hedge fund operator himself. It's Ratner who has been the point man for this despicable process on General Motors and so forth, right? Somebody people ought to know about. Why aren't people demonizing Ratner? You want to demonize somebody, try demonizing Ratner the Rat. Get rid of all that. Get rid of Nardelli, but then bring in competent industrial engineers who can superintend a process of recapitalization and reconversion. Recapitalization comes at 0%, 50-year loans from the nationalized Federal Reserve, the Bank of the United States. You'd be doing that on the way to Chrysler. And then you begin to reconvert. So you look at those assembly lines. You say, well, there's a certain demand for private automobiles. Let's maintain that. Let's forget about these absurd fantasies of plug-in electric cars. You don't have the technology. If you had the technology, it would be fine. The fact is you don't have it. The only way that the Chevy Volt, for example, is going to work is if everything else fails, right? Imagine a plug-in car that will get you 40 miles of driving. What if you get lost? Then the Chevy Volt is going to run out and you're going to have these huge batteries, right? A lot of toxic batteries to dispose of. I'm amazed that even the green extremists are interested in something like the Chevy Volt. Anyway, you can forget the Chevy Volt. What you want to do is, if you must have these automobiles, make them as efficient as you possibly can, but obviously you want to use urban mass transit to remove some of the a quarter of a third of the cars from the road. Anyway, nationalize Chrysler, seize it. Kick out Nardelli and the boys from Cerberus Hedge Fund or any other hedge fund. Get competent industrial engineering management in there. Begin reconversion. Tractors for the third world. High-speed rail, meaning maglev rail, urban mass transit, possibly maglev, possibly other kinds of high-speed rail. Components for nuclear reactors, you're going to have to build at least 100. Modular components for the 1,000 hospitals, you're going to have to build in this country and 10 times more around the world. Think about, well, I think we've covered it. Space, nuclear, tractors, the rest of it, rolling stock for various kinds of rail. These are the things that Chrysler Corporation could rationally build. Why allow factories to stand idle? Why allow workers to be unemployed when political will plus credit puts them together, gets them back to work, and builds the things you need as a permanent addition to the capital stock of the United States and a permanent increment in the productivity of labor? You get out of a depression not by jiggling money or tinkering with currency or whatever the hell it is, replacing one metal with another or paper with metal or metal with paper. You get out by production, producing, making things. Interesting profile this week. The number of people in the U.S. Congress who have any experience at all in manufacturing industry, i.e. making things, you can count on the fingers of your hand. It's obviously increasingly parasitical, decadent, post-industrial economy. It's very, very similar to the Spanish Empire in the early 1600s, where the prestige was still there, but the real power was a shell. And within a couple of decades, it went down. It went down cataclysmically. That was called the 30 Years' War. What's it going to be called this time around? It's better not to collapse the U.S. Right now, we're looking at a period where General Motors will be closed for 7 weeks. Chrysler will be closed for we don't know how long. And probably Ford will also have to shut down because they're getting to 120-day accumulated inventory. So this is an absolute disaster, but it is absolutely coherent with the anti-industrial, anti-trade union, anti-blue-collar profile that any fool could see with Obama when he was campaigning in Ohio and in Pennsylvania. Now, of course, Limbaugh is doing yeoman service for Obama. Limbaugh's line on this is, scandal. Obama criticizes hedge funds. How dare he? How dare you criticize Oppenheimer, Zirion, and Stairway? Well, those are big players who have been brought on the stage, right, to be whipped like in the old comedies. That's what they're there for. And don't believe any of this nonsense. So the policy is actually clear. Now, the depression in the meantime is getting worse and worse. The shrinkage, the contraction of the U.S. gross national product. Now, gross national product or gross domestic product is a very dubious entity because it's filled with hot air. I mean, they count financial services and God knows what else in gross national product. But even so, it has some vague indicative value. U.S. gross national product shrank by 6.1% in the first quarter of 2009 after having shrunk by 6.3% in the fourth quarter of 2008. So this is annualized basis. So the depression is statistically basically back where it was in the worst time of October, November, December. Nothing better in real terms. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C., surveying the wreckage of Chrysler Corporation, the U.S. auto industry, and the prospect, of course, for a virtual shutdown of auto manufacturing in the United States over the next couple of months. What Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo, and Mao wanted to do, shut down U.S. industry, is being done by Barky Obama under left cover in the service of Trilateral Bilderberg Wall Street, under any name that you want. Now, the reality is the fascist corporate state, think about it, the Mussolini fascist corporate state, corporatism or neo-corporatism, which is what we're dealing with here, is the idea that you have a state-sponsored compulsory cartel for the purpose of driving down wages and reducing production while at the same time propping up as much as possible capitalist finance paper, that is to say, in this case, derivatives and securitized asset-backed securities and what have you. That is being done, but notice that within the corporatist model, there's a big role for unions. There's a tripartite idea. The Mussolini fascist corporate state is a fascist-dominated company union, trade union, but really a company union, with management and government. So it's a three-way deal. The unions are either busted. I mean, if there's a real union, they destroy it and replace it with a fascist company union. And that's sort of what's going on under Gettelfinger and somebody like Andy Stern over the at the Service Employees International Union. Again, the appropriate response of the labor movement to all of this would not be to accept 45% of Chrysler Corporation worthless stock in exchange for your real concrete health care needs for your members in the future, plus other people that are going to be employed. You'd go for a general strike. You'd go for a mass strike against this entire package. But the moral senility of this country, the decadence and depravity of the entire political situation is such that we don't have that. We have people out demanding that essentially IMF shock therapy be visited on the country, but nobody seems to realize that if you don't have factories and industrial workers, you don't have a modern state. You don't have a modern life. You're gonna collapse. You're gonna be the plaything of other forces, and they may be hostile or not, but they're gonna treat you according to their needs and not yours. So this is a very, very grave situation. We said that the gross domestic product of the U.S. shrank at the rate of 6.3% in the fourth quarter of 2008. Now we've had a shrinkage of 6.1% in the first quarter of 2009. So the depression is on, and this is merely the prelude to the depression. This is not the real thing. But interestingly, we are now already the worst decline in 51 years, 51 years. This takes us back to the 1957 Eisenhower recession. Very, very serious economic downturn. Essentially, this ends the post-war upswing in the U.S. from 1947 or 48 until about 1957. You have positive picture. There is a recession in 1953, but it's not that bad. 1957 is a very serious recession. But even the Eisenhower administration, now let's look at it. This is what passed for a liberal Republican at that time, but it is the New Deal world that he's living in. Notice that Eisenhower has the very good sense not to be a fanatic or an Austrian nut and say, well, I'm going to dismantle Social Security and the entire New Deal state. He doesn't do that at all. Rather, Eisenhower has the good sense to say, let's do two things. Let's have the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It's founded by Eisenhower. And he says, let's build a huge interstate highway system, the greatest road-building project since the Roman Empire, 2,000 years. Those were good things. Without NASA, this economy would have already collapsed. And even though the interstate highway system today looks more like a World War I pockmarked battlefield with shell holes everywhere, at the time it was built, this was also a great achievement. So these are examples. You get out of a depression by producing your way out in terms of a science driver like your space program or modern infrastructure like your interstate highway system. And instead with Barkey, we have the famous Barkey two-step. You drive Chrysler into bankruptcy, and then after you put them at the mercy of the hedge funds, you set up this charade, right, this game of parts where you blame the hedge funds for doing what hedge funds are going to do. It's like throwing somebody into a cage full of ravenous lions. You can't then blame the lions for doing what the lions are going to do. They're going to devour the victim. So these are, I think, quite indicative. Now, think about it in terms of recovery. You've got to obviously nationalize the Federal Reserve. That becomes the Bank of the United States. You put out $1 trillion or $2 trillion. You can put out unlimited quantities of 0% federal credit, federal lending, not federal spending, not coming from taxation, but just created out of the inherent credit-generating power of the U.S. federal government, the most powerful institution in the world, if properly run. You wouldn't know it today, but it is potentially the most powerful institution in the world still. And then what do? Let's look at the panoply. We've talked about some of this already. 1,000 modern hospitals with an average of 500 beds each. You've got a tremendous deficit in the inner city and in the high plains and rural America, Appalachia, and the rest of it. Minimum 100 modern fourth-generation pebble bed high-temperature nuclear reactors. 50,000 miles and more, if you can, of maglev rail supplemented by various kinds of urban mass transit systems to get some of these cars off the road to do something about the 2 weeks a year that the average person spends sitting in a traffic jam. You've also then got to rebuild all water systems, all sewage systems, locks, canals, and everything else, plus new construction there. And you've got your three science drivers. You've got your space program. That would be NASA, dating back to Eisenhower. You've got to have industrial production, exploration, permanent colonization of the moon, Mars, and other nearby objects. You've got to have your high-energy physics program for thermonuclear fusion power, antimatter, and beyond. And thirdly, you've got to have your biomedical research program. Now, that's one of the things we'll talk about in just a minute connected to swine flu. But if you had a real government, instead of getting up there and saying, well, we're trying to mitigate the consequences, a real president would say, I am declaring a crash program, Manhattan Project. We will have a cure for swine flu within 5 to 6 months, so you can begin immunization in the fall, in September, October, in time for the new season. Otherwise, you don't know. You're taking a leap in the dark. We'll talk about this in just a minute. But in particular, let's also look forward to the coming week. The stress tests, Geithner, Tiny Tim. Geithner, of course, with Geithner, the U.S. federal government descends into chaos every time Geithner opens his mouth. The stress tests, these were examinations of the risk profile of 19 of your large money center banks. And out of these, about the top 8 to 10 are the center of the derivatives plague. I would say a priori, without looking into each and every case, just about all of these 19 banks are zombie banks. They're zombie institutions. They sit there and they speculate. They speculate to drive up the price of gasoline that you pay, and they put out derivatives, but they do not lend for plant and equipment, and they have not lent for many decades. So we'll talk about the stress tests in just a minute.
Are
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. We're looking ahead now to the stress tests of the leading zombie banks, the too big to fail. The clients, the people who own Obama and who own Geithner, we're talking Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase. We're talking about Ken Lewis of Bank of America. He got touched up this week. He got canned as the chairman of the board, although he continues as chief executive officer, and of course he's as corrupt as the day is long. All of these people are, forget the bonuses are outrageous, but the billions is what they do with derivatives. And then we've got Pandit the Bandit, Pandit of Citibank, and then we've got the leadership over at Wells Fargo, Bank of New York Mellon, the rest of them. These are your derivatives monsters, your zombie banks, and they participate in 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives. If you take the top 8 to 10 U.S. banks, you've probably got about a quadrillion of derivatives right there, with the rest of it being distributed around the world, something approaching 1 quadrillion. So the problem is 1 quadrillion dollars in the derivatives bubble. These banks are getting their stress tests. Naturally, with Geithner, the chaotic approach is axiomatic. Some of this stuff has leaked out now over the last couple of days. It was originally supposed to be announced on May 4th, but now it has been delayed until later next week, meaning this week as you hear the program. It could be Thursday or Friday. Anyway, it's Geithner, so it's going to be as chaotic as can be. This is, by the way, I don't think this is exactly planned. This is just incompetence and stupidity and jejune infantilism coming to the fore. The leaks that have come out so far are that Bank of America and Citibank, surprise, surprise, are both bankrupt, and therefore they need to be bailed out with more billions of taxpayer money. Remember, the Obama administration stands ready to come up with another $750 billion, that is to say, a second TARP, a second bailout for the banks. Obama's ready to do it. Hopefully the Congress, with the proper prodding from the citizenry, won't do that, but that's going to be the plan. So what I think we can expect is next Thursday, Friday, maybe, or sometime in the near future, Tiny Tim Geithner, the tax cheat, will come forward and say, we need several hundred billion more, and then that will probably grow. He might say, well, we need 750 billion or a trillion, but you can give it to us in two tranches. Remember, it's not just that this is criminal, it's that it's futile. You cannot bail out a black hole. Both Citibank, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, most of all, those three in particular, but also the others that we've mentioned, are bankrupt in a way which is qualitatively beyond the usual understanding of bankrupt. They are derivatives monsters. In the case of J.P. Morgan Chase, it's several hundred trillion of derivatives. There's not enough money in the solar system to bail out even one of these banks. It cannot be done. Therefore, everything that is done in this regard is futile. And what it means, of course, is the national suicide of the United States. If you look at the Chinese stimulus program, it's a real stimulus program. It means building railroads, roads, hospitals, and other permanent infrastructural improvements that increase the capital stock of the Chinese nation and increase the productivity of labor in China. And if you look at everything that Obama does, as I said before, out of the 12 or 13 trillion that he has thrown around between himself and his friend Bernanke and Geithner. So he's got the Federal Reserve coming into the administration and taking over in the name of Wall Street. Of course, the corresponding amounts for reconstruction, 50, 60 billion if you're lucky, science, oh, 10 billion. It's peanuts. It's chicken feed. The main objection to the stimulus is that it's too small. The objection to the bailout is there shouldn't be any bailout. The objection to the stimulus is that the critical categories are far too small. You're dealing with a combined infrastructure deficit in the United States, which is what? $6 trillion? $7 trillion? $10 trillion? Hard to say, but you're certainly never going to get there with $50 billion at a time and call that a program. Whereas, by contrast, you could save the entire TARP. You don't need to do any of that. What should happen? It's Friday afternoon again. Let's call Sheila Bair at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and say to her, Sheila, why are you being a criminal? Why are you violating the law? How come you haven't seized J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citibank? It's worth remembering that back under the first Bush administration, Bush the elder, yes, seized Citibank quietly, surreptitiously, in a stealth manner, one Thanksgiving. The controller of the currency and the FDIC showed up at Citibank and said, guess what? You're seized, but we're keeping it quiet. Some people understood bank runs in the Far East on Citibank, but it has been done. It's just, I'm trying to show you, Obama is far worse than Eisenhower. Obama is worse than Bush the Elder. It's just worse. Things that these people could do, Obama is simply incapable. This guy is fecklessness, writ large, and of course evil, because there's an active side to it that these other people didn't have. So we're going to be told more bailouts than these. Get set to fight the bailouts. And again, I stress, anybody who mixes stimulus and bailout is a fraud. They're either so ignorant that they shouldn't be talking, or they're saboteurs and wreckers and God knows agents of what. The big campaign is against the deeply unpopular bailout of Wall Street predatory financial institutions. I don't care about beekeepers. I think beekeepers are actually fine. Somebody wants to put earmarks in to keep the beekeepers going or some similar project, great. There's probably some community that lives off of that. But the one thing that we cannot allow is to have more hundreds of billions convoyed into Wall Street. That's now what's coming. Now, the TALF, we're now in the world of Barkey's alphabet soup, right? Let's just remember, under the real New Deal, the Roosevelt one, you had PWA, WPA, Works Progress Administration, Public Works Administration, building needed infrastructure and creating jobs for people. FERA, Federal Emergency Relief Administration, saving people's lives who otherwise would have starved. TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, solving the problems of flood control, electric power, malaria, rural electrification, basically making economic life possible in an entire great river basin of the United States, when the vaunted private sector, so much loved by Calamity Schles, never did it. That's the real alphabet soup. But here in the Brocky, we have PPIP, TAF, TALF, TARP, and all the rest of this garbage. We'll be back in a minute. Back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. We're told that Madame Parvenue, Madame Obama of the White House, has attended an anti-poverty event dressed in Lanvin sneakers estimated price $550 a pair. This is typical, although it's simply a cultural sign of the greater problem. Now let's look at the swine flu epidemic and the general problem of epidemics: bird flu, swine flu, SARS, whatever it may be, whatever it could turn into in the near future. Let us approach this first of all from the objective side. You notice that when we talk about a recovery program for the United States, there are two relevant provisions. One is the need to build at least 1,000 large, modern, fully equipped hospitals in various parts of the United States, stressing in particular the inner city ghettos and such disadvantaged areas as Appalachian, Southern Mountains, High Plains, North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, places like this, because you need a geographic distribution in these hospitals. You don't want to be so far away from the hospital that you die of your heart attack or stroke before you can get there, because time is of the essence when these things happen. So the 1,000 hospitals is an absolute component of any recovery program, plus one of your three science drivers is biomedical research. So a real government, a real president would say, we are now facing this possible swine flu epidemic, whatever this is. What do we do with it? We defeat it. We outflank it. We crush it. And therefore, a crash program, a Manhattan Project to find a cure for this kind of flu or any other kind of flu within 4 to 5 months. And the question is, how fast can you spend money? You want to spend as much as you can, as fast as you can, usefully. There are limits to how much you can spend. And those are largely, as you can see, they'll turn out to be how many trained people do you have and how much in the area of plant and equipment and capital goods do you have ready to go? In other words, what's your surge capacity in biomedical production? That's a crash program. You're not going to hear anything about that from Barkey until it is jammed down his throat. You can see this blasé, ignorant character, rich, distant elitist in the White House who says, yes, well, we have flu every year and 35,000 people die, and that's just normal. And this kind is actually mild. Yeah, mild, but it's too bad if you died. And again, the main thing is, what's it going to look like? Now, let's get down to bedrock. There is something called the Hill-Burton Act of 1946. End of World War II. So it's the late New Deal by now. It's the Truman phase of the New Deal, maybe the middle New Deal or late middle New Deal, whatever you want to call it. This is Lister Hill of Alabama and Burton in the House. So the Hill-Burton Law, and what do they say? That the federal government is going to provide financing to build hospitals, with the target being, in 1946, there should be 4.5 beds for every 1,000 of the U.S. population. And they got pretty close. By about 1965, this had been more or less fulfilled. Top levels of hospital beds in the U.S. got to be 1.5, 1.6 million by the end of the 1970s. But now, we have got a tremendous deficit. We have lost 1,000 hospitals, largely places like D.C. General here in Washington, D.C., a great high-level hospital destroyed by the Anthony Williams banker regime, similar to Obama, pilot project for Obama, if you want. And similarly, all those people up in the High Plains and rural America in general, very, very much underrepresented in the world of hospitals. So here's the thing. In 1946, it was thought, this is now 60-plus years ago, two-thirds of a century ago, 4.5 beds per 1,000. What's the situation today? Larger population, right? You got about 300 million-plus population of the United States, and you'll find that the number of hospitals in the U.S. has gone down by about one-third in the last 25 to 30 years. since the coming of stupid Reagan and the Reagan morning in America. We're down from 1.5 million to 1.6 million hospitals to about 950,000, the exact figure, 945,199 at the end of 2006. Now, that gives us a hospital bed per thousand ratio of 3.2 hospital beds per thousand. Now, think what this means. It's a 50% difference just to get to the level that was thought adequate in 1946. So we are now 50% below, we're one-third below, I guess you can say, looking at the standpoint we once had, we're one-third below the 1946 target level. And if we want to build back to what was considered adequate two-thirds of a century ago, we would have to increase the current number of hospital beds by one-half. You'd need to have a 50% increase. And as I've summed it up, you need 1,000 modern hospitals with an average of 500 beds each. Right? That gives you your extra 500,000 beds. That gets you up to approximately 1.5 million. So you've just worked your way back to the level considered adequate in 1946. But this is decadence. This is destruction. And, of course, this is not going to get the attention of the current trilateral Bilderberg regime in Washington, D.C., where George Soros has a permanent agent in Pelosi's office and more or less runs the show. Newark, New Jersey lost 37% of its hospital beds over the last, 10 years. And generally, hospital beds have decreased 13% in the last 10 years. And those were Bush years. Those are not good years. From 1985 to 2000, it was a loss of 26% of the existing beds. So right now we're minus a third compared to where we were. And above all, we have got to add at least 50%. I mean, if you wanted to have any kind of a modern target, you'd have to say double the existing beds. That would mean 2,000 modern hospitals with an average of 500 beds each. Obviously, some of them smaller, maybe some of them larger. Everything adapted to community needs, obviously. So that is your failure to meet the Hill-Burton criteria. So that is one of the key components of a recovery program. 1,000 modern hospitals with about 500 beds each, with the entire array, the trauma center, emergency care, stroke unit, heart unit, and all the rest of it, plus all the kinds of outpatient services and so forth that come around. We need to go back to the New Deal. If we'd stuck with the New Deal, we'd have 1.5 million beds minimum, and probably more like 2 million beds to be able to face this current situation. And this leads to the larger issue. Everybody's worried about the conspiracies. Yes, the conspiracies involved in the swine flu. Fine. The world is full of conspiracies. And when you get down to the level of biomedical science as it exists today, it's clear that all sorts of people have the ability to unleash new forms of pandemic disease. And there's not much you can do about that. They're out there. So what are you going to do? We get to the point now, is politics mainly a matter of complaining, or do you propose to do something about it? We'll be back in a minute.
GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Thank you.
Crisis Radio. We are here in the land of the giant hedge fund. If Obama has a model of what the federal government should be, it is one giant hedge fund derivatives monster, or, if you will, a huge Enron. That seems to be Obama's model of the modern state. It is a government controlled by zombie bankers with their zombie ideas, by hedge fund hyenas, except for the few that don't play along in the required way. And instead of In God We Trust and the currency, they're going to put cash for trash, that is to say, the Geithner PPIT program. So we are now in the land of the TARP, of the TAF, of the TALF, and the PPIT. And let me remind you, you're better off in the realm of the PWA, the WPA, the FERA, the TVA, and the HOLC, the Homeowners Loan Corporation. That was another good one, to keep you in your home, and we should put some teeth into that. Somebody is advertising on various radio programs here in Washington a one-year ban on foreclosures. That's good, but it's got to be, and a binding one, it's got to be 5 years or the duration of the depression, whichever lasts longer. Let's just get back to this question of the swine flu epidemic. Your main answer to this is build 1,000 modern hospitals with 500 beds each. And when you've done that, you probably better go out and build 1,000 more. And you're going to keep them, and you're not going to have just-in-time inventory when it goes to all this stuff. And you're going to need a crash program to find some cures. And the more you can cure, the more money you can save. But that's the only way you can spend money, not through rationing of care, not through euthanasia, as recommended by the Hemlock Society. You get the impression that the Obama administration is dominated from the inside by the Hemlock Society, the suicide cult, or Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, or kooks of this nature, the die with dignity people, in this case, die without dignity. That seems to be running the show. The Tom Daschle imperative, borrowed from Governor Lamb of Colorado, another famous genocidalist, that the people who are sick or old or whatever it is should simply succumb. They should suppress themselves in order to save the bottom line of Connecticut General or whatever insurance company they're working for. Let us just recall one thing. The danger of pandemic diseases grows out of economic collapse and economic decline. The big examples of pandemics in world history are all directly correlated with periods where bankers and other exploiters have taken over the society in the name of usury or banking, or sometimes it's even enough just to have a really expensive royal or imperial court, or a parasitical class of aristocrats who spend the surplus and more. When you have that kind of domination, and that is what we have now with the banker regime, the Wall Street puppet Obama, you have forms of austerity, that is to say, the lowering of the standard of living, a downward pressure on the standard of living of the average person, generally because wealth is being transferred into the hands of bankers, aristocrats, oligarchs, and of course the derivatives are the greatest example of that that's ever been cooked up. It's under these conditions where you have a weak, depleted, exhausted, malnourished, underfed population that lacks clean water, lacks hospitals, lacks adequate mass transit and things like this so you can get around and move goods. That's when you get the huge pandemics. Now, I know a lot of people say, well, what about the conspiracy? Yeah, conspiracies. I'm big on conspiracies, but you've also got to realize the objective possibility of a pandemic doesn't come from the conspiracies. It comes, apart from some, you know, Hollywood scenarios, it comes from what I just said. It comes from a population whose immune system has been decimated by forms of economic austerity, the kind of stuff that bankers like, austerity, sacrifice, the kind of things you're hearing now from Obama. Let's just give a couple of examples. One of the greatest incidences of the bubonic plague, in retrospect, turns out to have been in the 4th century A.D. The evil Emperor Justinian of the Byzantine Empire, with Theodora, his consort, this woman who came from the circus, from the hippodrome, and then generals of the Byzantine army that he had running around, getting essentially re-extending is after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West. So it's basically it's a little bit after 500. What he's got is he's able to re-establish the Roman Empire of a certain sort along the Mediterranean littoral, and it's not obviously on the Rhine or in the interior of Gaul or in the interior of North Africa, but just sort of a strip along the Mediterranean coast. And that's a terrible time. That's when those Irish monks have to get out of the Mediterranean and flee all the way up to Ireland to get as far away from Justinian as they can, because this guy is just poison because of this austerity program that he's got going. Out of that comes a huge incidence of the bubonic plague, known as the Justinian plague, all around the Mediterranean basin. Classic example, the big bubonic plague, the Black Death of the 1340s, this comes as the medieval civilization of Europe is collapsing under the weight of what? Under the lending practices of Venetian and Florentine bankers, your Bardi, your Peruzzi, and your Venetian, so-called Lombards, right? The English term meaning Lombardy, meaning northern Italy in general, including, therefore, from their point of view, Venice. Venice plus Florentine bankers, the loans that they made to Edward III in order to launch the Hundred Years' War, the Venetian encouragement of Edward III to attack France in the Hundred Years' War. And, of course, you've also got cultural breakdown. Every time I hear the name William of Ockham cited as if this guy is some kind of an authority, right? Ockham's razor. People on the internet like to say, well, your argument doesn't meet Ockham's razor. This guy was an example of the corrosive breakdown of the culture of the Middle Ages, right? William of Ockham is bad, bad news. The stupidest of all the medieval nominalists, and in many ways the roots of some of the cultural poisons in our modern time. He's a little bit, when you have the breakdown of a society, you have forms of cultural decadence that comes out. In the case of Diogenes the Cynic, for example, of the Greek city-states, a sign that the culture is destroying itself. William of Ockham, same thing for the culture of the High Middle Ages. He is the negation of it. So that's the Black Death, and actually the contaminants are there, and they're going to be there no matter what you do over the long run. But the thing is, how does it spread? It spreads because people have already got malnutrition and the rest of it. The Spanish flu of 1918-1919, this is a clearest example of them all. The existence of World War I, trench warfare, where millions of people are involved in trench warfare, plus the British sea blockade of continental Europe, cutting off food, medicine, and everything else, sets the stage for this huge pandemic killing more people than the war itself. If AIDS comes out of Africa in the 1970s to 80s, you can say it took 30 years of conditionality and shock therapy by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to destroy the previous civilizations of Africa, even the civilization in Africa that had survived the actual European direct colonialization period, are destroyed in the newly independent African states because they all fall prey to the lending practices of the IMF. And now we've got the post-2000 Bush austerity. So if you want to close the door to new pandemics, crash program for cures, 1,000 hospitals, and then another 1,000 as fast as you can, plus restore the standard of living in the United States, which has declined by two-thirds since the high point of Lyndon B. Johnson, 1967. That is to say, 40 years ago. We'll be back next week on World Crisis Radio.